Okay. We'll begin the committee meeting, and do you have, what's the minutes? The Representative Holberg moves the minutes of February 27th. Is there any question on them? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, carries. The first bill on the agenda is Representative Murphy. And would you step up, and I believe Representative Holberg, you'll move the bill.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 455 for consideration by the committee, and then I'd also like to move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like to discuss it.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is modifying the public defender laws that are in statute, and it's basically a housekeeping bill, and Mr. Kyer is here to explain it.
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. The bill that you have, or I should say the strike everything amendment that you have in front of you, is basically the result of a couple of different things. One is some Supreme Court decisions that have come down in recent years, and second is an updating of the statutes based on some work that our board did this fall and some planning sessions and some long-term planning things. So, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd go through it section by section and be as brief as I can and stand for questions. And
Mr. Kyer, I believe that unless somebody I'm seeing not a great need for going through it section by section so that we can get to the other bills that people want to discuss. Maybe you could do a three-sentence summary of it, and then we could go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the bill strikes references to public defender co-payments that have been declared unconstitutional. It renames the deputy state public defender into the chief appellate defender, removes some discretion to decline representation in post-conviction cases. Again, this is a result of a Supreme Court decision. And strikes some obsolete references. And the last one repeals a reimbursement rate that the judges aren't using anyway, and it's just not something that they've been using. So that's it.
Okay. Is there any questions on the bill? Representative Holberg, would you like
to
move it to the consent calendar?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would, unless there's any objection, I would like to move that House File 455 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the consent calendar.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next bill is Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson, you can move your own bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move this bill, and I'll follow direction of the chair on this. I think it's non-controversial enough to go to the consent calendar, but I'll follow your lead on where to refer this to. I think it's non-controversial enough to go to the consent calendar, but
Representative Holberg or Mr. Verdon, do you?
Mr. Chair, I have a couple questions, and maybe I might be able to respond to that after I get some answers.
Why don't we handle it that way, Representative Johnson? Go through as if it's going to the register.
Okay, or that sounds very good.
Or possibly, looks like it would be a one to lay over for inclusion if it's not on the consent calendar.
Very good.
So why don't we take
either way satisfactory, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you go ahead and present your bill then?
This is a technical bill, committee and Mr. Chair, that allows county attorneys and social service agencies to conduct name-based national criminal history searches when making emergency placement of a child who's been removed from the home due to a child protection matter. So I'm just going to give you a brief background. This will be brief. Currently, the FBI requires that all national criminal history inquiries made for non-criminal justice purposes, such as this one, be fingerprint-based checks. And they have made an exception to this rule when exigent circumstances or emergency or pressing necessity circumstances exist, such as this. Upon approval by the FBI of a state law, such as the one you have before you, a name-based inquiry may be conducted, but then it has to be followed up by a fingerprint-based search. So just to summarize then, currently the FBI denies Minnesota's request for name-based searches because the statutory language presently in place lacks certain FBI requirements. And the FBI requires that the state law have three things. One, that it authorizes name-based searches. Secondly, that provides for the submission of fingerprints to the FBI within 15 calendar days of conducting this name-based search. And thirdly, the FBI requires that the state law provide the child or children be removed from the home if the subject does not provide the fingerprints. And what this bill does is address the absence of those three criteria that are current, that are not in current law. Now with me today is Julie Letourneau-Lachter. She's with the BCA to answer any questions that might result from this bill.
Ms. Lachter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Julie Letourneau-Lachter. I'm a manager with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
Go ahead.
I'll be happy to answer any
questions.
Oh, you
just answer questions. I know Representative Hallberg said she had questions. Representative Hallberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson, or your testifier, and I'm sorry.
Ms. Lachter.
Okay, thank you. Who does does the physical fingerprinting, and then how long are those fingerprints held in the federal database?
Ms. Lachter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hallberg. The fingerprinting would likely be done by a local law enforcement agency, and they are not maintained by the FBI. They would be submitted to the FBI electronically and then destroyed once they've made a determination if there's a record or not.
And Representative Hallberg. Chair, where in statute does it say they have to be destroyed following the check?
Ms. Lachter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hallberg, it does not say that, but that is the practice of the FBI, and there are several background checks that require fingerprint-based checks, and that is the standard practice.
And Representative Hallberg.
Mr. Chair, might there be federal guidelines that in writing somewhere that state that, given it's the FBI that's administering the program?
Ms. Lachter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hallberg, I don't believe there are guidelines in federal statute. They would comply with the wishes of the state, and thus far we have asked that they destroy those fingerprints. There's no authority to maintain or retain them.
Representative Hallberg.
And then just another question is, in practice right now, has there been any issue about time or costs with local units of government in doing the actual fingerprinting?
Ms. Lachter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hallberg, not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Is there any other questions from anybody on the committee? Then we'd be ready to... do you feel comfortable with it going to the
consent calendar? I think it can go to the consent calendar. I think in the meantime, I'd just like to find out. I know if somebody wanted to fingerprint me, I'd want to know how that was being used, how it was being stored, you know, when it would be destroyed, et cetera.
It can always be pulled off, as you well know.
Right.
But if you would like to make that motion, then Representative Hallberg.
Just so you don't use it against me, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move approval of House File 1008 and recommend that it pass and be referred to the consent calendar.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Passes. Thank you, Representative Johnson. The next bill that we'll take up is Representative Hellstrom's bill. No, we were going to do you
great,
at this
perfect.
Time because of you have an amendment that apparently has, I believe, has quelled at least some of the concern.
All right.
Representative Hillstrom, would you, this one I don't think we can send to the consent calendar.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 505 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. And then do you want to, I believe there's an author's amendment, 852, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Mr.
That?
Chair. There is House File 807-0152 that is an author's amendment that would put the bill in the order that the author would like it.
Okay. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With me is Al Drazil. With the Attorney General's Office. This, again, was brought to me by the Attorney General's Office, and it would authorize the court to grant a restraining order against a private computer network that publishes harassing information. And with that small introduction, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Drazil to talk about it. And
Mr.
he can answer his questions.
Mr. Drazil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Internet has resulted in new ways to harass and defame individuals. In the past, those who engaged in harassment or defamation did so in person, by mail, or over the telephone. This limited the scope and the spread of that activity. Today, it is cheap and easy, however, to create a fake Internet profile on social networking sites such as MySpace, or to send out mass emails pretending to be another person in order to harass or defame. With the Internet, a person posing as another with intent to harass, defame, or to spread false information can do so to thousands of individuals. Additionally, it is difficult to correct the misinformation once it's been disseminated because there's no way to assure that the correction will reach the same individuals who received the original false information. Our office was contacted with an example of this sort of behavior, and this is what motivated Attorney General Swanson to propose this legislation when she found out that this was not a solitary example. The specific case involved the parents of a 12-year-old who told how their daughter had been victimized by a teenage boy who created a false and defamatory website profile of their daughter in which he posed as her bragging, quote, I'm a slut, close quote, and other things along that line. Those parents had difficulty getting that website changed. They were finally able to convince a judge to issue a court order to halt the conduct. However, it was and it remains difficult for victims to stop Internet imposters. I talked just this morning with an assistant county attorney in Anoka County about some of the cases they have. Some of you may know about the Coon Rapids teacher up there that had some students posting a very defamatory website where he was supposedly supposed to be looking for what would be illegal sexual activity. And they since then have had two more teachers, one from Blaine and one from Fridley, where they've had cases come in where students have put up websites supposedly in the name of the teacher. And they're doing the best they can, but they're having some difficulty under the current law. The current law allows a person to apply for a harassment restraining order only if there are repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts or words. And the problem is a single Internet posting may be interpreted to be a single act and thus not harassment under the current law. By defining harassment to include a single incident of posing as another person without authorization for purposes of harassing or defaming that person, this proposal gives victims the right to more easily seek a harassment restraining order to enjoin the false or malicious website or online profile, and it allows the court to order that the offending content be removed from the site. Attorney General Swanson urges passage of this legislation, and his representative says I'd be happy to answer any questions, if I can, that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Drazil, and thank you for responding quickly when I called yesterday with the obvious problem in the bill I saw and getting it to the Republican caucus and everything. So I think it's okay now, but are there any questions, Representative Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question about some jurisdictional limits. I think it's a great idea, but I just wonder if you know, Has anyone in Minnesota run into problems where there's an out-of-state computer network and it's tough to get at? I'm just wondering whether federal action is also needed here, too.
Mr. Brazil?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, there is, in fact, a federal statute that deals with this information. In researching for this law, we found a case where a fellow in Atlanta started engaging similar sort of conduct with a woman he had once known who lived in Seattle. The problem is, to access the federal law, it's pretty much beyond the ability of most citizens. They need to go to their local court to try and get something through the federal court. It's not something they can easily do. But there is a federal law that would deal with interstate harassment of this nature.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering if there's anybody in the audience from the industry looking at page 2 and 3 of the bill. Actually, I guess it's just page 2. How this works, and I mean, I know enough about technology to survive with email, but I have not a clue how this would work in practice with whether, I don't even know if it's charter.net, if charter's the one that has to do this and what they do, or it talks about restraining orders can be issued against private computer networks, internet service providers, bulletin boards. So,
is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify on this bill? I don't see anybody but the people that are here for every hearing every day we meet. Not a lot of new faces today. Representative Filstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have had a website previously, and when I signed up for it, they made me check a little box saying that I understand that if they found anything to be objectionable, that they had the right to remove that information. So I would assume that as soon as they got something in the mail, that they would just invoke their right that they made me sign off on when I did my website.
And Mr. Chair, and then maybe Representative Hillstrom, is there a necessary timeline or, you know, certainly general restraining orders that I'm familiar with, when the judge orders it and it's served, then, you know, stay away or don't do this behavior, but there may be a need for some type of timeline, or have any industry folks contacted you with concerns about this?
Representative Felstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have had no contact from anyone, so.
And maybe the question would also be to Mr. Drazil. Have anybody contacted your office about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I do not know of anybody that's contacted our office, but let me turn around just a minute. I'm getting an indication from other people in our office that our office has received no contact.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Representative Kalin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick point that actually I can imagine that some of the people who might be interested in the bill may actually, if we were on TV, be watching online rather than in person, but also may end up listening to this recording. And so just to encourage them to email with their concerns, probably email the author, I would imagine. And so I just wanted to state that on record, if they are listening, just knowing some of my friends who do a lot of internet service providing, that this is how they communicate with the world. So.
Okay. Is there any other points or questions? Okay, then the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hawes, you're up. Representative Hawes, I'll move your bill for a possible inclusion since you're not on the committee. And do you want the 1166H1166A2 amendment on to put it in the shape for the author wants?
Yes, I would like that.
Okay, I will move that then. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries 3-0. Representative Hawes, you can go ahead.
Thank you very much. I would like to note that the amendment comes from the Senate and also the Minnesota Minnesota Auto Dealers Association helped amend the bill. This bill is a recommendation of my witness today, Lieutenant Jim Mortensen, And one of the things I think that makes government work is that we listen to citizens and we listen to the people and the experts in the field. I felt very uncomfortable when I first looked at this bill. And I thought, you know, why would that come from the very people that would make and enforce our laws? I remember a long time ago, I bought a pair of shoes, and I thought they were going to be the most uncomfortable shoes. And I wore them just about a half a day, and I ended up with a pair of shoes that was really very nice. So before we bow our backs up, and I think we should, and we question and debate, I would like the policeman from the field to tell us about his idea, to tell us about the bill, and why he would think that this would make a good law for Minnesota.
Mr. Morrison,
if you would.
I believe.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
What's your title?
Lieutenant.
Lieutenant Mortensen.
Back in 2003, I came up with this idea because in the city of St. Cloud, we were having an exorbitant amount of hit-and-run crashes that we weren't able to come to a successful conclusion and get prosecutions on them. We average around 375 hit-and-run crashes a year, and if we're lucky, we can solve 20 to 25% of those. There's many times where we get the license plate numbers on these vehicles, and we go to make contact with registered owners of the vehicles to follow up on it, and we end up running into a dead end. They either have a sudden case of amnesia, or they just don't and outright refuse to tell us who was involved in the crash. Under the school bus stop arm statute, this language is very similar that we're proposing here. And it puts the onus back on the owner of the vehicle if they don't want to be forthcoming on helping us solve this crime, because if you can imagine, there's 370 that occur in the city of St. Cloud each year. There's got to be tens of thousands that occur within the state each year. And there's victims out there that their vehicles get crashed into, and we aren't able to hold the driver responsible for their actions. These folks have to take time off from work. Their car isn't quite the same anymore once it's crashed into, and we just wanted to get another tool in our toolbox to go after the folks that are responsible for the violation. And with that, I hope I summed it up quick enough, and if anyone has any questions.
Representative Cornish.
Officer Mortensen, Mr. Chairman, how does this differ specifically from the school bus stop arm law? Isn't there something in the school bus stop arm law about contacting the owner within so many hours or finding them or some time limits or something?
What that is it allows us to actually take them, if I recall correctly, it actually allows us 4 hours to take them into custody. The difference here is this is a petty misdemeanor. This is not an arrestable offense. They'd be issued a traffic citation.
Representative Holberg.
Representative Howes, unfortunately, I don't like your bill. I've been talking with the red lights, RoboCop people. They always like to bring up the school bus safety arm as their justification for doing that as well. And someone here at the table, I don't recall, who talked about bad laws being those that make criminals or lawbreakers over of law-abiding citizens. And basically we're getting back at the owner of the vehicle being held responsible in many instances for the behavior of others. And your amendment, certainly as I read your amendment, I'm thinking, I mean, right now I have four vehicles in my name. They're being driven by owners of my family of various ages, and I've certainly permitted the possession and operation by another person. And so, you know, I mean, I just think that if you're a law-abiding citizen and if you were to come to me and say, we believe your car was involved in a hit-and-run, I would provide you whatever information I could regarding who was driving the particular vehicle in question and do the right thing, and this law will make me guilty rather than allow me to be just a good citizen and do the right thing.
Representative Foss.
Mr. Chair. Representative. You know, and where this bill is almost there, because it says that if somebody is charged, you're not going to be. So when you tell the people, your family or your friends that you've given this all out to, and they were the drivers, and your family says, not me, not me, you, Mom, you take the petty misdemeanor. When it's that down into that category, somebody of those four was driving the car. And I would say, I'd want a new family if they did it to me.
Mr. Chair, we can't pick our families.
We should an adoption program.
You're not going to trade in your family for a new
No, this is
very good.
With all the challenges and unique characteristics, they're mine.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Pauls, did you have?
I don't know that I was on the list, but I do have a question. Thanks for calling on me, Mr.
You
Chair.
Your hand like this.
I'm rarely at a loss for words, Mr. Chair. Representative Hawes, I have some problems as well, and I guess the scenario that I'm thinking of is when I was a freshman at the University of St. Thomas, for a period of time before I was able to buy my own car, my parents were allowing me to use one of their cars.
Yes.
And on more than one occasion, I let some of my friends at college who needed to run to the grocery store or were going out to dinner or whatever use my vehicle. And it seems like under your bill, if they had gone and done something, my folks are on the hook. And you know, my parents lived in Maple Grove at the time. They still do, but they lived in Maple Grove. I was in St. Paul. They wouldn't have been anywhere near the vehicle. And to me, as Representative Holberg said, it seems like we are going a little too far here and making lawbreakers out of law-abiding citizens. Can you respond? I mean, am I understanding the bill correctly? I mean, would my parents potentially be liable?
Representative
Foss?
Chair, Representative, would you like to comment or would you like to...
Sure, I can comment on that.
Lieutenant Morton.
Thank you. The intent of what we're looking at here is to get to the driver. It's not to go out and slate the mom and dads of the world. You know, if I go and make contact with mom and dad, they should be able to tell me that my son uses that car at college. Then I should be able to go to you and say, were you driving the vehicle at that date and time? And you're going to say, no, it was my friend. Case solved. This is more along the lines of when we go to interview that registered owner, and they just refuse to cooperate with us. Or they put up this brick wall that won't allow us to solve this crime. And that's the intent of where we're heading with this, not with bright mom and dads out there that borrow their cars to their kids.
Representative Qualls?
Mr. Chairman, I understand that, and I don't know that current policing practices would prevent you from going through that scenario where you contact my parents and they say that I'm driving the car and you come and see me and I tell you that I let my buddy drive it to the grocery store. I guess what I have a problem with is the civil libertarian in me recognizes that I don't have any obligation to talk to you about anything. It's your job as a law enforcement officer to prove up your case. And we're putting, it seems to me, I'm not saying that we are running afoul of the Constitution here, but we're coming pretty close. I don't have an obligation to talk to you, and we're putting an obligation on somebody and saying, well, if you're not going to talk to me, I'm going to charge you. To me, that just strikes me as coming pretty close to running afoul of some of the constitutional protections that we all afford. I understand we're going to lay this, I think we're laying this bill over, and you know, whether it ultimately gets included or not in an omnibus bill, you know, we can have that debate for another day. I'm going to stop now, but if you can respond to that, Representative Haas, and then I'll let somebody else talk.
Representative Haas. The the art of compromise would be very, very good. And our compasses, you know, probably are not, you know, right in line on this issue. But I wouldn't want to be, you know, charging somebody that really wasn't responsible. But on the other hand, I do not want groups making sport of the law, too, just to be getting out of it when they know that in this group somebody was guilty of that. And if we all say, absolutely not, I have that right, and that's where it differs from, we get to commit a crime without a punishment. And so those are the two compasses. Now, is there something in between there? Maybe we can talk, or maybe we can work on it before it would ever go in, that we could find something that would get us closer to that alignment.
Representative Coles, did you have any more? Okay, then the next one is not a satisfying answer. Representative Farnish.
Mr. Chair, Officer, the problem I've got with it, I guess, is I feel comfortable if it was something in there knowingly allow rather than just knowingly permit. In other words, if you knowingly allow somebody, an unlicensed driver, to drive, if you knowingly allow someone to operate a vehicle intoxicated, and a number of other things. But on this one, you don't know anything. You just know that you've given permission, and then they're off helter-skelter. And it would be like, you know, there's lots of things we can't get prosecuted that we'd like to and fix with legislation, and one of them is when somebody gets involved in a DWI and leaves his car in the ditch and immediately gets home and calls it in stolen. We know it's bullcrap that it wasn't stolen, that he drove it in the ditch, and he comes in with a bad leg from the accident, but there's still nothing you can do to prove it. You'd like to fix it, but you can't. And this one that's the analogy I see here. We're like to fixing a problem with hanging something on somebody, or at least threatening them so they make the other person give up on what they did, and it's a reach for me. And so if there's something that could be fixed about knowingly allow somebody, but I mean, I still don't know how you're going to do that, how we're going to tie the owner into knowing that it was used in a hit and run, even stretching it that way. So.
Representative Haas, when Representative Parnish is with you on a law and order one, you got problems.
Maybe we can just, you know, check if he's got a gun permit and put him away that way. What do you think?
You're done? Okay, yeah. Representative Lash.
Thank you. Lieutenant Mortensen, when you run into a situation right now with a hit and run, what are the options that you have for charging and investigating that incident if you do not have evidence on you who the driver is?
None.
Do you think?
Representative.
Oh, thanks. I'm gonna throw one out there of what I see commonly. How about no proof of insurance or no insurance on the vehicle? Do you sometimes have that with respect to registered owners?
Lieutenant Mortensen.
Correct. We do sometimes, if we would ask that if they had insurance on the vehicle at that time, that it could go back on the owner of the vehicle.
Okay.
You know, they weren't involved in the crash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Lieutenant Mortensen, in these cases, do you sometimes get an answer back when you call an owner of a car and they say, you know, it wasn't supposed to be driven. I didn't know it was supposed to be driven, but someone took the car and drove it, and yeah, I didn't have insurance on it. Do you run into that situation from time to time?
Lieutenant Mortensen?
Yes, sometimes we do.
Okay. And I would just make a comment, Mr. Chair, that, you know, it's not too dissimilar to that statute that we have right now. I mean, I prosecute people all the time for no proof of insurance or no insurance on a vehicle when they're the registered owner of the vehicle, and oftentimes it's our only option when it's a hit and run. We see these hit and runs all the time, and we'll get an owner who will say, hang on a second, it wasn't supposed to be driven, and of course they're letting people drive it all the time, or they're driving it themselves, and all we want is restitution for the actual hit and run damage so a person's not out there deductible or what have you. So I actually don't see this as being that egregious because it's done pretty commonly in the case of no proof of insurance.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious, Lieutenant Mortensen, have any of the law enforcement organizations or organizations representing municipalities weighed in on this
Lieutenant
proposed
Walker.
Legislation?
I have not had any of them contact me at all.
Okay. And you didn't? Thank you, Mr. Chair. You haven't brought it to them to see what their opinion is on it or anything?
Lieutenant Mortensen?
No, I have not.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative De La Forest.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd just like to make a quick point. I think that Representative Coles touched upon but didn't quite make the right point. And that is that, as I read the bill and especially understand the lieutenant's testimony, this bill has serious constitutional implications. Not only do I have no obligation to cooperate with the police, I've got a constitutionally guaranteed right not to cooperate. My Fifth and my Sixth Amendment rights are implicated, and so what this bill is doing essentially, although we don't define a petty misdemeanor as a violation of the law here, a person could suffer a penalty under this bill for exercising their constitutional rights, and so I think it just makes the bill fatally flawed. That's my opinion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg, and then...
No, and Mr. Chair, my comments were to Representative Lesch's comments. State law mandates that you have insurance on vehicles that you own. There's a failure in that instance of the owner to do what they were supposed to do. In this instance, the owner could have done absolutely nothing wrong. This goes back to my good law-abiding citizens. But not having insurance on a vehicle in your name is against the law. That is a responsibility of car ownership.
Mr. Chairman, I respond. Representative Black.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, that's true. It's also against the law to not stay and leave the proper identifying information in the accident. Before you say, well, absolutely, but it wasn't the person to whom the car was registered. In the case of no proof of insurance, you'll have people who, if you don't have insurance on the car, it's supposed to be immovable. But in most of these cases, it's not. They just have it sitting out by the curb. And so technically, a person could say, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't have insurance on the car, but I didn't intend to drive it. In order to make sure they don't step through yet another loophole, we prosecute them for that. In this case, it's just another situation where, you know, if a person is not being honest, as I see it all the time, they say, well, you know, it was, you know, I wasn't driving it, and they were driving it, and they were having people drive it. So I just think this is another tool that's at law enforcement's disposal.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate what you're trying to do, sir, but I think I would echo the comments of my colleague, Representative De La Forest. It is constitutionally, it's not only constitutionally flawed, I think the constitutional problems are fatal. And I would just give Representative Lesch, since the area that he practices in is on the criminal side of the bar, you got to remember that on the civil side, we have Chapter 170.54, which is the Safety Responsibility Act. And I haven't done the legislative history to be able to tell you that this is, in fact, the reason it was put in place. But I would suspect that because of these constitutional issues and because of the problems that we've heard, which are, it's tough to show that when somebody won't tell you who is driving a vehicle, that law provides that regardless of whether it's got insurance or not, the registered owner of the vehicle under the Safety Responsibility Act is responsible for any damages caused by that vehicle, whether you know who the driver was or not. So there is a civil remedy that I think it's important that we talk about. I understand that Representative Lesch's office prosecutes and gets restitution, but regardless of whether there is a basis for prosecution, there is a civil remedy specifically in law under Chapter 170.54 that addresses this situation.
And I understand that, Representative, and I know there is in many of these cases a judge will leave restitution up to the civil process, but people may remember we just jacked the civil filing fees up to $240, depending on how much it is, you know, small claims or not. And I just think in many cases that's sort of onerous for a lot of people to have to do, especially if they don't have a penny to their name.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesch, that assumes that you're dealing with damages that are in excess of $7,500. And most of these property damage claims involving hit and runs, I will tell you from experience, most of them are within the jurisdictional limits for conciliation court, which is probably $50 to $75. So while it's a point well taken, there is another venue.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To a point of this discussion, looking up the statute on 1.17 and 1.19 of the actual bill, we list subdivision 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and actually don't reference subdivision 5A. And staff has just told me that 170.54 has actually been recodified as 5A. And so it's so just wanted to share that with the committee because it was my curious to me that it wasn't included. And so that does indeed cover this case law shows that it covers the civil action that you're talking about, the civil liability, Representative Emery. So just it is embedded in the statute now within the appropriate, nice work by the reviser to move it in the appropriate area.
Thank you. Looks like, okay, any other issues? Okay, then this bill is laid over for, Representative Webstrom.
Well, just to echo some of the same concerns, and then I guess the question, and I think I got part of the answer, you were talking about laying this over.
Yes, sir. That's the motion.
What?
For possible inclusions.
Okay, so we'll revisit it when we get to the omnibus bill or something, potentially.
Potentially.
Okay. So, well, Mr. Chair, I wonder if we really don't have procedures in place that can take care of this now, and when people are being, I assume you've interviewed people, and if they refuse to talk to you, that's a constitutional right, but then there's more probing that can go on, and they are under oath, and if people are going to lie to you under oath, there's also perjury statutes that they can be prosecuted on. So proper investigation seems to me they can come at it from a couple different ways to put enough squeeze on people to tell who, in fact, was borrowing the car that day, and then they can come up with their own alibis. And so, Mr. Chair, I hope it's laid over for... Just laid over, Mr. Chair. I'd like to amend it if I could, but I won't, Mr. Chair. But
well, Representative Weston, there's a new... We heard those on facts, Representative Coles and De La Forest would know, it's a new motion that's laid over for possible inclusion, which is a new creation by Representative Lencheski, or Chair Lencheski in there. With looks like no further debate, this bill is laid over for possible inclusion then in the omnibus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, thank the committee, and thanks for my witness, and thanks for the peaceful debate. You can see that every coin has two sides, and I appreciate your side. And as you think about this and something dawns on you that we can repair that and come closer, contact me, and I'll also think about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Hawes. Meeting's adjourned.